It is June the 21st. We are in Parshas Chukas, and we had finished the discussion of the Parah Aduma. We went through the Psukim, we went through the Halachos. Now we're going to cover a little bit of the depth of the understanding behind the Parah Aduma. We mentioned already last week some of the similarities that Rashi brings out between the Parah Aduma and the Egel HaZahav, that the Parah Aduma is a kapara, is an atonement for the Egel HaZahav, for the golden calf, even though the halachic reason for the Parah Aduma is to remove from ourselves the Tumas Meis, the Tumah of coming in contact with a dead body. Still, there is also an element of kapara, of atonement for the Egel HaZahav. This connection is fairly direct because Avodah Zarah is considered to be Zivchei Mesim. It's considered to be the sacrifice of the dead, is what it's called. It's called Zivchei Mesim. And so we find similarities between dealing with the dead and dealing with Avodah Zarah. And so the Parah Aduma is the counteracting force to Tumas Meis, to Tumah of coming in contact with the dead body, and that it also atones for the Egel HaZahav, for Avodah Zarah, that does fit together. Rashi already tells us that many of the elements of the Parah Aduma reflect what happened with the Egel HaZahav. For example, the Parah Aduma has to be a Shalo Allah Aleha Ol, that it does not have a yoke, never had a yoke upon it. Just as we, unfortunately, threw off the yoke of heaven when we worshipped the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. It says, V'ikhoi lecha farah aduma tzimima. They, the Jews, should take for you. They should pay for it. They should find this parah aduma, this red heifer, and pay for it, just as they financed the Egel HaZahav. As we know, the gold was given to Aaron willfully to create the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. The Parah Aduma is burned into ashes, and then it is mixed with water and sprinkled on the Jewish people. We know that when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Mount Sinai, he smashed the Egel HaZahav into little tiny pieces. After he broke the Luchos, he then took the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf, and he smashed it into powder, similar to the ashes of the Parah Aduma. And many other types of similarities here in the parsha. The Egel HaZahav was done through Aaron HaKohen, and therefore the Parah Aduma has to be done through a Kohen. It's through Elazar, not through Aaron, since Aaron was the one who actually did the Egel HaZahav. So it's through his son Elazar. Nevertheless, it is a Kohen that processes the Parah Aduma, despite the fact that the Parah Aduma is not a carbon. It still requires a Kohen, similar to the way the Egel HaZahav involved a Kohen. All of these and many other similarities we find between the Egel HaZahav and the Parah Aduma. And I mentioned to you last week, the Chazal say a mashal, they say a parable, that if a child soils the paltrin shel melech, soils the palace of the king, tavo imo, his mother must come and clean up the mess. So here the Egel HaZahav, the Egel being a calf, a baby, so to speak, cow, it made a mess with the sin of the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. So its mother, the Parah Aduma, we have Parah is a female cow, Parah Aduma has to come and clean up the mess. That's the analogy Chazal tell us. There's a fundamental question, though, on this connection. And this fundamental question will trigger an entire perspective and understanding on the golden, on the Parah Aduma, and also the Egel HaZahav. Now, the truth is, we spoke about this way back when, in Parshas, where would we have spoken about it? We probably spoke about it in Parshas Bo. Actually, we probably spoke about it earlier. We probably spoke about it already in Bereishis. Many years ago, so some of you were present at that time, so it'll be a refresher for you, and for those who are not present at the time, this will be a new thought, hopefully. But I'll take you back to Parshas Beshalach, and a very important Rashi in Parshas Beshalach. In Parshas Beshalach, after we cross the Yam Suf and we sing Az Yashir, so on page 382 in the Stone Chumash, we have that the Jews came to Marah, the water was bitter, and Moshe was told to throw in a piece of wood, and it made, or a branch, and it made the water sweet. So the Pasuk tells us over here, on page 382, Chaf Hey, Pasuk 25, verse 25, Sham Sam Lo Chok Umishpat. There Hashem gave the Jewish people Chok Umishpat. He gave us some mitzvos in Marah. Marah precedes Matan Torah. It was on our way to Har Sinai that we came to Marah. And there Hashem gave us Jews some mitzvos. He gave us Chok and Mishpat. Now, Rashi tells us over here, what is Chok u'Mishpat? I'll read you the Rashi. B'mara nasan lahem miktas parashio shel Torah sheis asku bahem. In Mara, Hashem gave us some of the parashios of the Torah that we should be involved with them. Shabbos, that's actually fairly famous, that we were given the mitzvah of Shabbos already in Mara, prior to Matan Torah. That's why it says in the Aseres HaDibros, when it speaks about Shabbos, it says you should keep Shabbos ka'asher tzivisicha, like you were commanded. Where were we commanded? We were commanded in Marah. Similarly, Kibud Av Va'Em was given to us in Marah, and that's why it says ka'asher tzivisicha, like you were commanded. It says that as well regarding honor your parents. But Rashi here says, Shabbos para aduma v'dinin. Shabbos, para aduma, and dinin. Dinin means the monetary laws. How do we know that the para aduma, the mitzvah para aduma, was given to us already in Marah? Because it says that there Hashem gave us chok umishpat. We mentioned at the beginning of our discussion of para aduma, parshas chukas, which is the word chok, that a chok is a mitzvah that we do not, it's not naturally intuitive to understand that it is a required thing to do. That certain types of mitzvos are more self-evident, like don't steal, don't kill, and others are less, like kashrus, which don't have a direct reason that is so obvious to us. So too, Parah Aduma is the epitome of chok, as we mentioned. It is the greatest enigma of all mitzvos. It is the one that is the most difficult to grasp. And therefore, if Hashem taught us or gave us chok u'mishpat, He gave us a chok, in Mara, that chok would be para aduma. So that is a nice understanding of what happened there in Mara. The very, very significant question is that Mara, as we mentioned, took place prior to Matan Torah, before we got the Torah. If it took place prior to getting the Torah, then, by extension, it also took place prior to the Egel HaZahav, before we worshipped the golden calf. So then, how is it that the Parah Aduma is an atonement for the Egel HaZahav? How could that be if we were given that mitzvah before we actually did the sin of the Egel HaZahav? Then how is it that it could atone? An atonement would be something that we do to undo or make up for or correct the mistake of an Avera. So how is it that the Parah Aduma would be a correction of the mistake of the Egel HaZahav if the Parah Aduma was in fact given to us prior to us ever contemplating the Egel HaZahav? Now, it is true, and I'm sure many of you are thinking this, that we have a concept of Refuah Kodem LaMaka, that Hashem provides the antidote prior to the Maka, prior to the prior to the sickness, he provides the cure, and we learn that from Esther already becoming queen before the whole issue came up with Haman, so she was well placed to intervene on our behalf when Haman decreed his evil decree. In that case, though, it's true Hashem set up the refuah before the makkah. He set up the antidote prior to the sickness, but there the antidote was not a kapara. It wasn't an atonement. There it was a person who was well placed that she could take action if we were to make a mistake when we made that, when the problem came up with Haman, so Esther was there and ready to help us. But the mistake that we made that triggered Haman actually took place before Esther became queen. We had already bowed to the idol in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. We had already attended the Suuda, the festivities of Achashverosh, things that we should have not done. And because of that, Haman rises to power. So before Hashem brings that punishment of Haman, he places Esther in the palace, ready to save us, should we do teshuvah. Here, it's a little bit more difficult to say that, because here it is an atonement for a sin which we had not yet done. So how is it that that atonement can precede the sin? How is it that the Egel Hazav became the Egel Hazav? We'd actually discussed this in Parshas Kisisa. How is it that the Egel Hazav became the Egel Hazav? How did the golden calf come about? So Rashi tells us in Parshas Kisisa, Aaron says he took the gold, he threw it in the fire, and out came a golden calf. How did the gold turn into a golden calf? Rashi tells us two explanations. One is that when he threw the gold in the fire, the Erev Rav, those Egyptians that Moshe had accepted as converts into the Jewish people, they had not yet really given up their ways of being Egyptian, and they came with their kishuf, with their witchcraft, which was abundant in Egypt. They were all experts in witchcraft. And they performed witchcraft and turned the gold into a golden calf. That's what they did, and that's how it happened. That's one explanation. That explanation needs an explanation. Why did they turn it into a golden calf? Why didn't they turn it into a golden head of cabbage? Why didn't they turn it into a golden eagle? Why a golden calf? Why did they choose a calf? And the answer to that question is because that's what they were used to worshiping. Because the Egyptians worshipped the calf. The Pasuk says in Yirmiyahu, Egla Yefefiya Mitzrayim, that Egypt is a beautiful calf. The Malbim says there that the Egyptians would worship the golden calf. Not golden, they would worship the calf. That's what they would worship. It was a common Avodah Zarah in Mitzrayim. Now, there were many Avodah Zarahs in Mitzrayim. They worshipped the Nile River. They worshipped Paro. They worshipped the sheep, as we know, when it comes to the Karban Pesach, that the sheep was something which we took, which was to show that we trusted in Hashem that He would protect us, even though we were telling the Egyptians we're going to slaughter their God. But their primary worship was not the sheep, was not the other things. It was the calf. That was, if not the primary worship, one of the primary worships in Mitzrayim. And therefore, when the Erev Rav came and were going to turn that gold into an Avodah Zarah, that which they chose was the calf. Because that's what they were familiar with. That's what they had connection to. That's what they wanted to see when it came to Avodah Zarah. If the Egyptians worshipped the calf, and that was such a prevalent worship, that the Egyptian Erev Rav, when they had to choose an Avodah Zarah, they chose the calf, then it stands to reason that we Jews had been exposed over our 210 years in Egypt to the worship of the calf. Now, we were also exposed to other worship as well. But just as the Erev Rav, their Avodah Zarah of choice was the calf, it stands to reason that the Avodah Zarah that we were most exposed to was the calf. Which means that the Avodah Zarah that we were most vulnerable to was the calf. Because we had seen that worship over and over and over again in Egypt. And if we were going to stumble and fall and begin to worship something, the calf was a very enticing Avodah Zarah. It's something that drew us because it's what we had seen. It was our experience in Mitzrayim. Therefore, when the Erev Rav made the calf, because that's what they were familiar with, we Jews jumped right in because we were also familiar with it, even though we had not worshipped it, but we were familiar with it. It was something which we had seen, which we understood. We understood how to worship it. We understood how it's done, what to do. It wasn't a foreign thing to us. Because we were vulnerable to the worship of the golden calf, of the calf, the Para Aduma was given to us in Mara. It was given to us before Matan Torah. Why? Why did Hashem give it to us before Matan Torah? Now, one could say He gave it to us before Matan Torah because we needed to purify ourselves from Tumas Meis. That's a good answer. But in addition to that, that would be the halachic reason. What about the deeper understanding of it? The Hashem, being well aware of how vulnerable we were to the worship of the calf, He granted us the Para Aduma in advance, not to atone for the Egel Hazav, but to prevent the Egel Hazav. Hashem gave us the Para Aduma as a prevention of the Egel Hazav, because the Para Aduma is the antithesis of the Egel Hazav. And the Para Aduma, therefore, was given us in Mara to prevent us from slipping and worshipping the Egel. Unfortunately, it didn't work to prevent us. We slipped up anyway. Despite having the Para Aduma, we fell. And we did worship the calf, the golden calf. At that point, the Para Aduma reverted to becoming a kapara, an atonement. Where originally it was given as a prevention, once we sinned, it became the antidote, it became the atonement for the terrible sin of the golden calf. Rashi in Parashas Ki Tisa gives us another reason why the gold turned into a calf. The first reason, as we said, was because the Erev Rav, those Egyptians who were with the Jewish people, they turned it into a calf using their witchcraft. There is another explanation. That explanation, Rashi says, is that we know that when the Jews left Mitzrayim, in the beginning of Parashas Beshalach, it says, Vayikach Moshe atzmos Yosef imo. Moshe took the bones of Yosef with him. The Medrash tells us, how did Moshe Rabbeinu know where the bones of Yosef were? Because they were not readily available. The Egyptians had a very strong interest in keeping Yosef's remains with them in Mitzrayim, because Yosef had ruled the country for 80 years, which is an incredibly long time for one person to rule anything, certainly a country, the most powerful country in the world. And he had brought tremendous bracha to Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim became a world power, both militarily, economically, under Yosef. Yosef orchestrated Mitzrayim becoming a world power, maybe the world power. And they did not want the remains of Yosef to be removed from Mitzrayim. And the end of Sefer Bereishis, at the end of Parashas Vayechi, the pasuk ends off on an ominous note, that Yosef died, Ben Me'av Esar Shanim, when he was 110 years old, Vayachan Tu Oso, they preserved the body, Vayisem Ba'aron B'Mitzrayim, he was put in a coffin, in a box, in Mitzrayim. Where was that box? That box was at the bottom of the Nile River. It was sunk to the bottom of the Nile River to ensure that it wasn't going anywhere. When we were ready to leave Mitzrayim, Moshe Rabbeinu needed to bring the bones of Yosef with him, because Yosef made us swear that when we leave Mitzrayim, we will take his bones with him. You will bring up my bones from here, from this, with you. Moshe needed to know where to get the bones. So he went to Serach Bas Asher. Serach Bas Asher lived for a very, very, very long time. She was alive at that time. And he asked her where the bones were, and she told him where they were. They were at the bottom of the Nile River. Great. Now he's located the bones. How do you get them out? So Moshe Rabbeinu took a tas. A tas means a plate, like a plaque of metal, and he either wrote or engraved on the tas, Alei Shor, which literally means rise up, ox, rise up, ox, or bull. Rise up, bull, rise up, bull. Now, Alei Shor is actually a play on words, because the Pasuk tells us in Parshas Vayechi, in the bracha of Yosef, there Yaakov Avinu says, Banos Tzoada Alei Shor, that the young women in Mitzrayim who wanted to see Yosef, who was a very good-looking person, they wanted to see what he looked like, Tzoada Alei Shor, they would stand either Alei Shor on the wall, or Shor means to look, like in order to look. Now there, Alei is spelled Ayin Lamed Yud, which means on top of the Shor, the wall, or up tops in order to be able to see. Alei Shor is spelled Ayin Lamed Hey, not Ayin Lamed Yud, but it sounds the same. Alei, rise up, and instead of Shor, meaning wall or to look, Shor, Shin Vav Resh with an Acholam, rather than a Shuruk, an O sound instead of an U sound, Alei Shor, which means rise up, bull. So it's a play on words. And Moshe Rabbeinu wrote that on the tas, on this plate, this plaque, and he threw it into the Nile River. And when he did that, up came the bones, the box, the aron, that had the bones of Yosef in it. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu got a hold of Yosef's remains and was able to take them with him when they left Mitzrayim. That's great. What happened to that plaque? There at the time was Micha. Micha, not to be confused with the Navi Micha in Shrei Asar, Micha was also the name of the boy that Moshe Rabbeinu removed from the wall in Mitzrayim. As we know, one of the ways that the Egyptians hurt us very badly was that we didn't produce enough bricks to build the buildings we needed to build. They took Jewish children and cemented them into the walls to be the bricks, obviously killing them. Moshe Rabbeinu davened to Hashem about this. Hashem said that they are really going to turn out to be Rishayim. It's better that they remain where they are. But Moshe Rabbeinu insisted, and Hashem had Moshe Rabbeinu take one of them out. That one was Micha. Micha saw what happened when Moshe Rabbeinu took that plaque and threw it in the water, and he got a hold of the plaque. Doesn't say how he got a hold of it, but he did. And he had it with him. Then, when Aaron threw the gold into the fire at the time of the Egel HaZahav, he, Micha, took this plaque and threw it into the fire. And it said, Alei Shor, rise up, bull, and out came a calf, which is a baby bull, a golden calf. And that is the other explanation for how the gold turned into a calf. It is striking that the same words that would cause Yosef HaTzadik's remains to come out of the Nile River so that he could be buried in Eretz Yisrael, those same words would trigger that the gold that Aaron threw into the fire would emerge as a calf of gold to be worshipped. It doesn't seem right. Yosef HaTzadik, the great Yosef, who distinguishes himself by resisting the wife of Potiphar, he is called forever after Yosef HaTzadik. What kind how could it be? What kind of justice is that? That his, the same phrase that gets him to rise up out of the Nile River gets the gold to rise up and become a golden calf. That is such a terrible sin. How could that be? And the reason why that's so is because we have to understand a little bit better, why is it that the Egyptians were so connected to the worship of the calf. What made it that the Egyptians liked the worship of the calf, that they were drawn to the worship of the calf, that that was the worship of choice? And the answer is because the Egyptians have a connection to the bovine family. Egyptians are connected to calf, cows, bulls. Egyptians, the Mitzrim, have a connection to whatever the bovine family represents conceptually. The Egyptians are connected to that concept, which we will discuss, please God. Yosef HaTzadik likewise is represented by the bovine family. He is the shor. He is the bull. That's what he's represented by. That is what he's called by Moshe Rabbeinu and by Yaakov Avinu. Uver Tzonam Ikru Shor. He is called a bull. So whatever the bull slash cow slash calf represents, that is also what the Egyptians are connected to and what Yosef HaTzadik is likewise connected to. They are all connected to the same thing. Whatever the calf slash bull slash cow represents, the Egyptians are one representative of that, one projection of that, and Yosef HaTzadik is the mirror image of the Egyptians. The Egyptians and Yosef HaTzadik are two sides of the same coin. The coin that is represented by the bull, cow, calf, that coin, Yosef HaTzadik represents it in its best form. The Egyptians represent it in its most perverse form. They are two sides of the same coin. Therefore, it is natural that the place that Yosef would thrive and reach greatness and would achieve the leadership of the country is Egypt. Because in Yosef, the Egyptians saw a representation of something they were familiar with as well. Yosef was a foreigner, but somehow they related to him, and he related to them. There was a connection there, because both represented the same koach, the same strength. Yosef as a tzaddik, the Egyptians as rishayim, but the same coin nonetheless. Therefore, Yosef rises to prominence in Mitzrayim. That is where Yosef is tested the most by the wife of Potiphar in Mitzrayim, and that is where Yosef rules for 80 years and dies in Mitzrayim. And the Egyptians want to keep him in Mitzrayim. And therefore, the same plaque that gets Yosef out of the Nile also brings up the Egel Hazav, the Egel Hazav being a representation of the most perverse part of Mitzrayim, that of their Avodah Zarah. What does the bull, cow, calf represent that is shown in Yosef as a tzaddik and in the Mitzrim as Rishaim? What does it represent? Now, we all know that the Egyptians were interested in the worship of the sheep. We know that as well. As we mentioned, when we took the first Karban Pesach back in Mitzrayim, the reason why Hashem told us to take a sheep was to show the Egyptians that we do not care that they worship the sheep. We are going to slaughter it because Hashem told us so. And in doing so, we showed our loyalty to Hashem and Hashem protected us. But I thought that the Egyptians were connected to the calf. What's with the sheep? We know that every month has a mazel. There is a mazel, there's a constellation that is attached to each of the months of the year. Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, each one has a constellation. The mazel of Nisan is the tle, is the sheep. That fits very well with the Karban Pesach. Pesach is in Nisan. The Korban Pesach is a sheep. It fits very well that the month of Nisan's mazel is the sheep. Which month is the month that its mazel is the its constellation is that of the bull? That is Iyar, the second month of the year. The first month of the year is Nisan, represented by the sheep, and the second month of the year is, or the year as far as we count it, is the shor, is the bull, and that is the second, that's the second month. The Egyptians and particularly Paro were obsessed with the concept of Bechor, of being the firstborn, of being number one. The Egyptians fancied themselves as being the number one in creation, as being the Bechor of humanity. That's how they saw themselves, and Paro, himself a Bechor, saw himself as the Bechor of the Bechoros. He was the ultimate in humanity. That's the way he saw himself. Much of Yetzias Mitzrayim can be characterized as a lesson that Hashem is determined that Paro will finally learn that he and his people are not the Bechor of society, but rather, B'ni Bechori Yisrael. My son, my firstborn, are the Jewish people. Bereshis Bara Elokim B'Shvil Reishis B'Shvil Yisrael Shenuku Reishis, that the whole entire universe was created because of the Jews. We are the Bechor of humanity. We're the Bechor of creation. And the Bechor is represented by the sheep. The very first time you find the word Bechor in the Torah, you find it in Parshas Bereishis when Hevel brings a korban to Hashem, mi Bechoros Tzono, from the Bechoros, the firstborn of his tzon, of his sheep. And the Bechor represented by the sheep is represented by the month of Nisan, and Hashem says to us Jews, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim. This month is for you, the first of all months. Because Nisan is the month of Bechor, Nisan is the month of the sheep, Nisan is the month of the Jews. The Egyptians were Nisan / Bechor / Se sheep wannabes. They weren't Bechor. They were really Shor. They were really the second month represented the Egyptians. Not the first month, but they were first month wannabes. They were really second born, not firstborn. I say that conceptually. But they were firstborn wannabes. The Egyptians had a lot of talent, and they could have been successfully placed as, quote-unquote, the second-born of humanity. Perhaps they could have played a very, very powerful role in Hashem's plan. But the Egyptians were firstborn wannabes. In fact, Mitzrayim was a person. As you know, all the nations started off as a person, including us. Yisrael was Yaakov, Avinu. So Mitzrayim was also a person. Mitzrayim was one of the children of Cham, of the third son of Noach. Cham has four sons, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, Kenan. Mitzrayim is the second born of Cham, but Mitzrayim is a firstborn wannabe. And therefore, the Egyptians, although they were more naturally connected to the Avodah Zarah of Egel, of the calf, but they tried to champion the Avodah Zarah of Seh, of sheep, because they wanted to be the firstborn of humanity. And Hashem slaps them in the face and makes it clear to them they are not the firstborn of humanity. It is the Jews who are the Bechor of humanity. Yosef HaTzadik, likewise, was meant to be the firstborn. He should have been the firstborn. Yaakov Avinu should have married Rachel, and Yosef would have been the Bechor. That's what he would have been. But that's not the way it happened. And in the end, Yaakov marries Leah, and Leah has children before Rachel does, and Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, all of those are born before Yosef is born. Yosef is one of the last Shvatim to be born. He is the firstborn of Rachel, but he is not the firstborn of Yaakov Avinu. Reuven is the firstborn of Yaakov Avinu. Reuven was not able to be king because of his incidents. Neither could Shimon, neither could Levi. Yehuda assumes that position of king. And therefore, the Mashiach that we wait for is Mashiach ben David, is the descendant of David HaMelech from Yehuda, who will be our king, Bez Hashem, and Bimher V'Yomenu. But Yosef also has an element of leadership. Yosef, being the firstborn of Rachel, has an element of leadership. But not the primary element of leadership. The primary element of leadership goes to David HaMelech, goes to Yehuda. Yosef is a secondary leader. Yosef is a leader, but a secondary leader. He is the mazel of Shor. He's the mazel of the second in command, not the first in command. If you are the second in command, there are two ways of handling that. One can do it like the Egyptians, which is, okay, I'm second in command, but that's not good enough. I want to be the first in command. And constantly try to claw one's way to becoming the first in command, and always being unhappy with where they are, and constantly trying to usurp the first in command and be the Bechor, be the Seh, be Nisan. That's what one could try to do, which is what the Egyptians did. Or one can say, Hashem wants me to be the second in command. I'm going to be the best second in command that I could possibly be for the sake of Kavod Shamayim, for the honor of heaven. That's what Yosef did. Yosef never really became the king of Mitzrayim. Yosef was the Mishneh LaMelech. He was the second in command. He wasn't actually in charge, but he was in charge. Everything ran through Yosef, but he was the second in command. If there was a state dinner, Paro sat at the head, Yosef sat second, because Yosef was not the number one man, he was the number two man. But as the number two man, he was the best number two man there could be. And therefore, really, the country ran through Yosef. And ultimately, in his place in Klal Yisrael, Yosef is perfectly comfortable as the number two man. That's where Yosef is. That's what he's happy to be, because that's what Hashem made him. And he excels in it. Because Yosef HaTzadik excels at being the number two man, he is called what ought to be a contradiction in terms. Bechor Shoro. He's the first of the bull. What do you mean? I thought the bull is second, not first. The bull is represented by the month of Iyar, not the month of Nisan. But Yosef HaTzadik is the Bechor, is the first of the bull of the second. He is perfectly comfortable in being second in command, but he's the best of the second in command. That is the godless, that's the greatness of Yosef HaTzadik. Where the Egyptians can't handle being second in command, Yosef HaTzadik excels at being second in command. And therefore, Yosef HaTzadik and the Egyptians, as we've mentioned, are two sides of the same coin. It is the bull, it is the shor, the para, the eagle, that is represented by Yosef, represented by the Mitzrim, but two sides of the same coin. Overall, us Jews, relative to the rest of the world, including Yosef, us Jews, including Yosef, relative to the rest of the world, are represented by this Seh, by the sheep. We are the firstborn, including Yosef. We are the Bechor of humanity. But within us Jewish people, Yosef HaTzadik is the comfortable and perfect second in command, Mishneh LaMelech. And that is the concept of the shor, the egel, the para. we Jews, when we worshipped the Egel HaZahav, what we did is we embraced the Egyptian way of thinking about the concept of Shor, the concept of Para, the concept of Egel. We embraced the Egyptian way of thinking about it. And that resulted in Avodah Zarah. We did not embrace Yosef HaTzadik's way of thinking about it. We embraced the Egyptians' method of thinking about it, which was the Avera of the Egel HaZav. The Para Aduma, one of the things it's meant to do is to wake us up and refocus us on what the concept of Egel is, what the concept of Shor, of Para is, that we should think about it like Yosef and not think about it like the Mitzrim think about it. The Para Aduma is not a carbon, as we've said. The Para Aduma is something which appears to be a carbon. It's sort of like a carbon. You slaughter, you take the blood, you sprinkle the blood, but it's not outside the Beis HaMikdash. One does not even have to be completely tahar, as we've learned, in processing the Para Aduma. It could be a Tevul Yom, having gone to the mikvah that day, but the sun hasn't set yet. That's acceptable for Para Aduma. Para Aduma is a step down in Kedusha from Karbanos. Para Aduma, therefore, is not the top of the carbon concept. It is rather a step down. It is a second best, but not a best. However, in being that second best, it excels at it, and in the end, because, as we mentioned, that the Tzedukim tried to, the Tzedukim said that you cannot be Tamei at all when processing the Para Aduma, and therefore they deliberately made the Kohen Tamei in order to show that it can be done with a Tful Yom, and he would go to the mikvah right away, and then he would process the Para Aduma to show that it is acceptable with someone who's a Tful Yom. But on account of that, Chazal saw fit to enact many, many, many gzeros, many decrees to preserve the tara, the purity of the Para Aduma. So that even though the Para Aduma is not as strict or stringent as a carbon, and we make the Kohen Tameh on purpose, and then he is able to still, after going to the mikvah, he can still process the Para Aduma. But to offset that, Chazal had to enact many very, very stringent things in regard to the Tumah of a Para Aduma. And you had, as we mentioned last week, with the women who would have their children born on the Harabayis in the compound, in the structure of the Beis HaMikdash. And you had all the different rules we mentioned last week, all the different details. All of those things are more stringent than regular karbanos. In fact, if you go through the laws of Tumah and Tara, and you go through a hierarchy from lowest to highest, of what is the least susceptible to Tumah and what is the most, what has the fewest laws of Tumah, what has the most laws of Tumah. You'll start with chulin, with just regular food. Then you'll move a higher level is truma. You'll move to a higher level, which is kudshim, which is karbanos. And then you'll move to a higher level still, which is chatas. Chatas meaning the Para Aduma. The Para Aduma becomes the most stringent of everything when it comes to Tumah, because of the very fact that it's not the most stringent. This is the same concept as we find with Yosef. When someone embraces the role of being the number two person, they are actually, conceptually, the number one. They become the Bechor, and they become recognized as such. That is the concept of the Para Aduma. And that's the concept of Yosef HaTzadik, the concept of the Egel HaZav, the Egyptians, and the Shor. All of this goes together into one general approach, which is all the depth behind the Para Aduma and this Chok, which has a lot that we don't understand about it, but this is much of the depth of the Para Aduma and something to think about with the Para Aduma. We are going to stop here. It's a little early. We're going to stop here for this week, and Mitzvah Shem next week we'll continue beyond the Para Aduma in Parshas Chukah. So we'll take questions. I see Mrs. Deitch has a question.
Thank you. How is it that Hashem... So did we really get the Para Aduma before the Egel?
That's what it says.
So then why is it that it didn't work? You said that there's something to the effect that Hashem wanted us to prevent the Egel.
Yeah.
According to this whole understanding, why is it that... where was the fallacy that we couldn't get... that we still maintain the Mitzrayim version of the Egel instead of the Yosef version?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have a good answer for you. I believe it has to do with what happened with counting the days when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to get the Torah. But I do not have a good answer to tie that in with exactly what went wrong in this regard.
Thank you. And is there... So we were saying that the Keves is a Bechor, or the Nisan, Rishon, and then the Par is Eor. So, but there is, in the Karbonos, when you bring a Par or a Keves, doesn't have that, any of that, value of, categorizing them that way, right?
No, you don't have it that way. There, in those things, usually has to do with what's a bigger animal. A Par is a bigger animal than a Keves.
The value.
Yeah, it's just a bigger... So therefore, you need more... Also, the Nesachim, you need more wine, more oil, more flour to process it because it's a bigger animal. But I don't know... You don't see it in an individual carbon. Some carbonos can only be one type of animal. But those carbonos that can be all the different animals, you don't find this hierarchy. That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Rabbi Pansky?
Yes.
What was Mika's purpose in throwing that sign in?
That's a good question. I don't know what his purpose was particularly. He later on is involved in Avodah Zarah and Sefer Shoftim. So it seems that he had some affinity for Avodah Zarah, and it's possible that he intended it for Avodah Zarah, but I don't know.
Really? Moshe Rabbeinu saved him?
Yeah, well, Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu that you'll see that it's actually better that they not be saved. I'll show you.
Oh. Uh-huh. Todah rabah, Rabbi Pransky.
Anybody else?
So, how is it that what's the whole idea? You know, everything fits perfectly in the story, nothing happens, whatever. So, how does that fit into the world and to the B'nai Yisrael that these people where Moshe didn't listen? Was that a bad thing? What's more about that?
Okay, so that's
the whole story.
Yeah, that's all story in itself. That needs explanation. What do you mean? Moshe Rabbeinu is going to argue with Hashem? Hashem said it's not a good idea. Moshe says it is a good idea. That whole story needs explanation. But that's not a regalachas. That's really a whole shiur how to deal with that. Okay, Mirza Hashem, we will continue next week.